All right. Hey, welcome back to the show. Patrick here. And this is the Patrick Podcast. So we're back, and this is the second episode of season two. We had our first episode of season two last week. And now it's time for a new episode. This one is with Patrick Rogers. He is the editor-in-chief of the Nashville Scene, a pal of mine. We were at a university here in Nashville around the same time, and we've been pals for a long time. And I had a wonderful conversation with Patrick. We are both named Patrick, so that's hilarious to have two Patricks. Part of me wishes that the Patrick Podcast was just interviewing Patricks.
I don't wish that.
There are some interesting Patricks in the world.
It might be less frequent episodes.
And the goal would be to interview Patrick Stewart, of course. Like, that would be, you know, the ultimate Patrick right now. I don't know. What is there another Patrick O'Neill? There you go. He would be a good Patrick.
Would you interview Neil Patrick Harris?
Oh, of course. Okay. Anyone with Patrick in their name. Right. Even the Kilpatricks. We'll get them in the mix, too. Even though I never kind of liked that last name, Kilpatrick, for obvious reasons. Anyways,
Patrick Rogers.
Patrick Rogers. Fun interview. We talk about music. We talk about kind of alternative weeklies, which is what the Nashville scene is. We talk about Nashville. We talk about a little bit of politics, kind of get in there a little bit. But it's a lot of fun. I think you're going to love it. I had a good time. I think you're going to have a good time. Hey, here's the deal. I want us to have like an engagement process, like you people who are listening, talking back to us who are making the show. So best way to do that is to follow us on the Instagram. That's the Patrick Podcast. That's our IG account, I believe. And follow us there. I usually post a photo of the guest of the week, but in that comment section, leave a comment, ask a question, leave your favorite quote from the episode, your favorite thoughts from the episode, whatever. Even if you have a roast. I don't mind a roast. I like roast. I like pot roast. I like all roast. Pig roast. Anyway, so please engage with us. And I would love to chat back because I want to hear your feedback about what we're doing here on the show. Also, if you haven't already, go to iTunes. I know I say this so many times, but go to iTunes. Give us a rating. Please, maybe the 5-star. You know, that would be awesome. And leave a comment, because that truly does help us move up in the rankings of the podcast world. And yeah, and share it. Share the love. Give this to friends. Give it to family members, coworkers, randoms, whomever you want to give it to. But yeah, I think that's it. I don't have anything crazy happening in life right now. I'm just excited to get the fall started. I think it's going to be a wonderful new season. Wherever you're at, I hope that you're keeping cool in this summer heat, if you are dealing with summer heat. But yeah, there we go. But before we get into this, Ben, what's happening over there?
Hey, not much. I mean, I got nothing this week. I just say, if you live in Nashville or in the Middle Tennessee area, be looking out for times and schedules for Live on the Green, and go check that out. It's going to be a real good time, and that's a great event that happens in Nashville here.
Yeah, Live on the Green and the Pilgrimage Festival.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe. So, don't get your hopes up.
Yikes. Okay, let's get into the episode. Thanks. Peace. Patrick.
Yes, Patrick.
That's great. I love it.
At first I thought maybe the podcast is just it's Patrick.
Yeah, it's just Patrick.
So you should have on guests that are only named Patrick.
That would be great.
You'd run out.
Patrick Dempsey, Patrick Swayze.
Oh, well, you might have a problem getting a hold of him.
Yes. RIP. But we could have, who else is a good Patrick?
Patrick Starr.
Yes. Patrick, you know, Starr. I noticed people bring, has this happened to you? Normally, most of my life, people say, what's your name? Oh, Patrick. But in the past, like, 5 years, people said, like, Patrick Starr, SpongeBob. Yeah. This has happened only really recently. I think it's just the generation of people who grew up with that show are, like, just young adulthood or...
really into it, Which, I never watched it.
I didn't either. It was a little after my time, but, like, my nieces and everything watched it, but I don't know. I had a drag queen just last week say, oh, like Patrick Starr. I was like, yeah.
Was the drag queen dressed in, or was she like out of?
Was
costume?
She dressed like Patrick Starr? Just in her general dress? No, she was just in her drag, you know, persona. She looked amazing. I actually was like, you're beautiful. Yeah. You look beautiful. And she's like, oh, thank you. What's your name? Yeah. Oh, like Patrick Starr.
Oh, okay.
It's a nice moment.
Now, was this like at an Exxon or was it at an actual?
It was at number 308, a watering hole over on the east side.
Wait, they do drag shows at 308?
She was just hanging out.
Still in drag.
Sometimes drag performers are just out and hanging. It was around Pride, so maybe she had done had performed, but she was just kind of hanging with her friends and looked great.
That's good. Well, Patrick, I'm glad you're here.
Yeah.
That was a fun intro to the episode. So there's so much to talk about with you. You've had, from someone who has just been friends with you and have like watched you do your thing here in the city of Nashville, it's been interesting to see the spaces and places you have like existed and have like made this, you know, in some ways I would say that you're a pretty well-known person in this city. I think that's a fair statement considering what you do.
Well, and you know, in media you kind of have to put on the somewhat public persona thing, but you know, you look at like a Demetria Kalademos or a Bob Mueller or somebody who's been on television and television media for like 3 or 4 decades, and it's like, oh, they have household name status. I'm just sort of a dude who runs the local rag, but it's a cool thing to have been able to do for the past decade.
Yeah. So for those that don't know, Patrick is the editor in chief of the Nashville Scene, which is I was looking up, I guess the technical title for the scene is
an alt-weekly.
Alt-weekly.
Alt-weekly. Yes. So it derives from an alternative weekly newspaper, sort of the earliest, the Village Voice is really known for establishing what the voice of the voice and the format of the alt-weekly is. And that's changed a lot over the years, but we still kind of, I still embrace that term very closely. That's important to me. The alt-weekly is what we refer to it as. A lot of people call it a magazine these days. That doesn't bother me. It reads like a magazine. It looks like a magazine. Right. So that's not really.
Yeah, because this, even when I remember when I first moved to Nashville, early 2000s, the Nashville Scene looked very different than what it looks like now.
We went from newsprint to glossy pages in, I think, 2009 when we changed ownership. Because the newsprint thing was big. We were owned by the Village Voice Media Group, which owned the Village Voice and several alt-weeklies. And shortly, around the time of the recession, they shed a lot of papers, and we've changed hands more than once. But one thing that a former owner wanted to do was go glossy. It looks more permanent if you go glossy. People feel it's less, disposable if it's glossy pages. And I found... I like the way the photos look on glossy pages. It's really, you know, I think our largest impact is with our readership online as well. It's kind of a combined thing for us.
Sure.
I look at both to be equally important. But, you know, yeah, the newsprint thing, that throws people for a loop. They don't know if they're looking at a newspaper or a magazine or what.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I often wonder when people make those statements like, oh, people value it more when it's glossy. Or I feel like I always find myself running around people that that say, oh, people are going to love it if we fill in the blank.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if by people they mean a person has said that to them one
right.
time.
Anecdotal.
Like, yeah, one right. person said mm-hmm. to you one time, this would be great. And you're like, oh, people would love right. that.
Yeah. In our business, there's what's called media audits where you, you know, you'll figure out a way to talk to your readership and see what they prefer, see what they spend their time reading and looking at. The decision to go glossy was made by somebody who I think he thought that was sort of a value move.
Right.
And now that we've done it, I think people are kind of used to it. Really, anytime you change something, people are alarmed.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter if it's me becoming the editor in chief or going to glossy, people are like, nah, they're in trouble. Like anytime we've changed anything,
anytime.
People are like, ah, they're in trouble. Because, you know, we work in the print industry and it's kind of, I'll just say, atypical for us to still be thriving in print in addition to digital.
Seriously.
It's
yeah.
not very common. So
yeah.
I think people are always kind of waiting for the shoe to drop. But in our case, we've managed to make it work.
Yeah, it works. And people in the city still, like, that's a part of, if you're going to be a new business, if you're going to have an establishment, you got to have a space or a spot for the Nashville scene.
Like, happy to hear people still feel that way.
Yeah. Because I feel like that's when I go into new spaces is almost like that's, mm-hmm. you know, because you want to be featured in a scene. You want to be, mm-hmm. you know, known that like, oh, this we're legit. We've got an article or a piece or mm-hmm. a cover story or something. Mm-hmm. I think it still has that. And I'm always looking for when I go to new cities, what is the city's like? Where's their scene? Where's yeah. their alt weekly magazine that lets me know what shows I should go to and what food I should be eating, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So
I love that. I'm very much that way myself. And
yeah.
and something that I mean, I grew up reading the scene, being from the area. And when I'd go to other cities, I'd pick up their alt weeklies. And I like to read music reviews and film reviews. So I was reading dudes like Grail Marcus and Robert Christgau and people who were published, critics who were published in these alt weeklies
right.
who came from that kind of background. And it's cool because it's alternative media. We're not owned by and large, these papers aren't owned by big corporations. They're
right.
not your CNNs, your Viacom kind of,
right.
it's smaller local companies. So you're hearing, you know, more voicey stuff, people who aren't really afraid to speak truth to power or
mm-hmm.
to talk about art in an interesting way, or say no to advertisers who,
yeah.
you know, want this or that. So I was always kind of drawn to it because it's professional and I always thought it looked good and I liked how it read, but it was rebellious at the same yeah. time.
So have you had an experience like that where you've had to be on the phone or in face-to-face contact with a company, a business that wants to advertise in the scene and you're like,
well, luckily,
I don't think that's going to work out.
We have a pretty, we've always had a very firm line and I think most viable news organizations have a very clear line. If you work in editorial, by and large, you do not work in sales and vice versa because
right.
that's to avoid conflicts of interest.
Yeah, that's
so
good.
I do not deal with advertising.
So you don't even deal with that?
I don't deal with it.
You don't know
but
who, yeah.
That said, I mean, you know, I took ethics classes. I got a journalism degree
right.
at Lipscomb University, which we're kind of technically within right now.
Yeah, we're arm's reach.
So, you know, I took ethics courses. I studied journalism. It's extremely important to me. So I know where that line is. I know that if an advertiser is saying, well, you know, we bought an ad, it sure would be nice to get a review. I can tell them, you need to stop having this conversation with me right now.
Right.
But that, you know, people who are in sales don't necessarily have that background. So more often than not, over the years, it'd be somebody in our sales department's like, what's wrong with giving a shout out to them? They advertise with us. But I have a very sort of a core ethical base that I just know what's okay and what isn't. And so it's pretty easy for me to say, you can't approach me with that kind of request. That doesn't mean if they advertise in us, they don't get a write-up or
sure.
they do, or if they don't advertise it, it doesn't have any effect. As a matter of fact, I don't like to look at the ads until I'm looking at the entire paper.
Right. That's good.
So I hold that line pretty hard. So I haven't had to have that kind of conversation with advertisers. There have been people in the history of my working at the scene in sales who
mm-hmm.
didn't know where that line was. And sometimes it's a good faith thing and they just don't understand.
Sure.
And other times it was less a good faith thing and I had to sort of say,
right.
don't do that.
Don't
but
do that.
Everybody we work with right now is wonderful and great.
So now, for you, with that strong ethical like stance that you kind of now are, you just kind of described, is that all credit to the classes? And like, where does that, for you, where does that come from? And how you do your journalism, how you exist in the world.
Sort of, yeah. Is that learned or
inherent? Yeah, is that learned, or is that something that you learned?
It's some of both, because I'll say this right now, I've worked with more people who didn't study journalism in college, or at least didn't major in it or go to J school. I've worked with more people at the scene who didn't than who did. And those people have just as firm an ethical base as I do of, you know, some of the most, you know, like upright, ethically upright people I've ever worked with didn't go to journalism school.
Oh, no.
Some didn't even go to college. So no, I would say it's sort of an understanding of journalism. I learned a lot of great tools going to journalism school, and I would never not recommend it for somebody who thinks that that would help them. But at the same time, if it's something, if you talk to other journalists, if you have an understanding of the importance of journalism, of the importance of things like recognizing conflicts of interest and, you know, knowing what's right and what's not, that stuff, you know, kind of comes naturally. And if you follow that sort of thing through, it's like when I just told you, you know, oh, I don't talk to advertisers, it's to avoid conflicts of interest. That clicked with you right away. I mean, you're like, oh, of course, that way you don't. So most people know what that kind of stuff is. And not only that, but your readership recognizes it in a flash.
Oh,
if you're
absolutely.
Like just writing up the people who are advertising with you, if you, I mean, like, you know, your voice disappears and people don't take you seriously anymore. So, that's kind of a gut thing. Anybody who's in journalism and is sort of meant to be in journalism understands that at their core. And I've never really worked with anybody on a professional level that didn't get that in some way. And the people who don't get it kind of get out of that line of work because it's not really for them.
Which is interesting because you, in a sense, you did it, right? And what I mean by you did it is you went to high school, graduated from high school. You went to college, you majored in journalism. Mm-hmm. Now, like, you're doing what some freshman at a journalism school in wherever, like, hopes to one day do. And you're doing it in a sense of, like, for a lot of people, they go to journalism school, they go to music school, they go to wherever, and they don't end up working in that field. And that's almost been like the working conversation for people. It's like, well, you may not end up doing what you majored in, but college does so much more for you, yada, yada, yada. But you actually like, I came here to study this, and now this is what I do. So what was that like for you to like, not to like, okay, here's what I want to do, and I'm sticking to this thing, and I'm gonna, and now I'm doing the thing that I have always, quote unquote, always wanted to do?
Well, first thing I have to acknowledge is the amount of luck and privilege and help that I've had from people in my life from day one. I mean, when I say day one, I'm adopted. My parents, you know, like if I could have been, you know, raised by a completely different family. So my parents from day one made sure that I had everything I needed. I did get a scholarship to Lipscomb, but you know, if I'd had to hold down two jobs in high school, maybe I couldn't have had the GPA that would have gotten me that. So from the very outset, I've gotten a lot of lucky breaks, and working in journalism, I've gotten a lot of help from a lot of smart people.
Right.
That said, I knew I wanted to write very, very early on. I mean, I actually was planning on being a political science major when I came to Lipscomb. But, you know, I also, in high school, I kind of flirted with the idea of going into medicine, but every kind of different path I chose, I just always wrote. I always knew I wanted to write. I wrote fiction. I wrote poetry. I wrote, opinion pieces for our rinky-dink high school paper.
What was that? Like, what was it about writing that, like...
Man, it was... I don't know. And, you know, I'm kind of jack of all trades, master of none. And, you know, I play music and I do all kinds of things that I wouldn't say I'm great at. But the only thing... that, like, from day one felt as natural as anything possibly could, outside of playing second base in baseball, was writing. That was absolutely, amazing. I mean, it was just day one. My mom even, like, I'm just going to embarrass myself for no reason. But she keeps a clip. I wrote this letter to Santa in kindergarten, and they published it in the Hendersonville Star News.
That's amazing.
Because it was, and you know, it's like, it's nothing. It's just like a, but from day one, I recognized like a pretty good voice with this stuff, and that I just never got sick of it. Wow. I shouldn't say this, it's going to happen. I'm going to knock on wood, but like, I don't really get writer's block per se. I just like, if the way I was thinking about writing it isn't working, I just start writing in a different way and something else forms. So most people, I mean, we all struggle with inspiration and that kind of thing, but for whatever reason, writing was the path that just no matter what I was studying, I wanted to write. So I just followed that thread.
So yeah, so keep going.
Well, I just followed that thread. Yeah. And then I had a really great teacher in high school. He was an economics and a government teacher. And he sort of got me interested in law, but I was really interested in music and playing music. And I read the Nashville Scene, and I read, you know, I would pick up books about music criticism in college, and I wrote for the Lipscomb, the Babbler, it was called at the
shout
time.
Shout out.
Shout out to the Babbler. And it was just like, no matter what, and like pretty much by the time I would finish my freshman year, I was like, yeah, it's journalism for me and English minor. And I don't know, it just called to me. And really, you know, it was criticism that called to me, because the thought of being able to make a career out of forming arguments and just voicing your opinion, but being good at it, was just like so cool and intoxicating and awesome. I wrote a review of the Outcast movie that came out.
Idlewild. Yes,
I wrote a review of Idlewild when I was here, or when I was at Lipscomb in 2000. Yeah, I was six or whenever it came out, and I just remember, like, you know, seeing people on campus read it and just be like, wow, look, that's, they're reading. And then, of course, you know, they told me you can't review any more R-rated movies. That one slipped past the editor. But, you know, it was the kind of thing I was writing about, like a Sean Lennon record came out. I reviewed it, and I had free reign to write about whatever.
That's amazing.
So just like, I would just write about anything that I was kind of into. And I just knew that I had to pursue it, whether or not I would be lucky at.
So you grew up here
in Hendersonville.
Hendersonville.
Yeah.
Shout out to Hendersonville, which is also the land of Taylor Swift, you know.
It's true. She did, she went to the same high school as me. Not at the same time.
At the same time. Mm-hmm. But same high school.
Also, fewer people know this. Diplo also went to that high school.
What?
Yep. He was ahead of me, she was behind me. Yeah. Diplo was in high school as well.
Diplo went to
Also noted local journalist and my employee J.R. Lind went to Hendersonville High School. It's a stacked list.
So, yeah, that is a very interesting list.
Yeah.
So what was that like? Like, so, I mean, you kind of, you know, you let us know you were adopted and and you had this family, live in Hendersonville. So what was that like for you growing up on kind of this, I guess, the suburbs of Nashville?
Yeah. It's, you know, the nature versus nurture thing has always been really interesting to me, because I come from a place where, and I look, I'm just another like middle class white guy, you know, there's nothing particularly special about me, but I could just never jive with that culture. There was always something about Hendersonville that it was just.
Hey, so you still can't name it. Can you?
I also don't want to sound condescending in any way, because it's like a great place to raise a family. And there's obviously a lot of great people.
There's a Cheddar's there.
There's a Cheddar's. But it's not a bastion of cultural enlightenment. And, you know, not that I was like, you know, into Monet and you know, whatever else when I was in high school, but I was just trying to. I was just trying to see something different and read different things and listen to music. It was a little different. Man, I listened to some bad pop punk and some bad emo, but all of that was kind of in pursuit of
something. Oh, now I want to know who that was.
Something. Oh, it's as bad as you can think.
Oh, boy.
But, you know, at the same time, I was like, that. I consider those things sort of gateways. Like,
oh, absolutely.
I got into Green Day, and I'm not really slighting Green Day. I think Green Day is a perfectly
They're
good
fine.
Band. But, like, that got me interested in The Clash and then, you know, or the Velvet Underground or whatever it was. And I just sort of, art was primarily music, but also film and visual art, was sort of my gateway to just learning about places that were different from Hendersonville. And, And so I do credit my upbringing. First of all, very supportive family, but I credit growing up in that kind of community with like forcing me to understand myself as an outsider in some way.
So you never had a family, the family kind of unit never tried to draw you back into the thing. They were fine with letting you, okay, this is where it's leading. This is where he's got this creative spirit. Let's just.
My immediate family is like extremely supportive, like crazy supportive, really wonderful people.
That's
and
great.
I think part of that stems from, you know, they were, you know, they adopted, they were trying to have a kid for so long and they adopted and they were waiting to bring a child into their life. I mean, wouldn't it be kind of counterintuitive to finally have this kid and be like, don't be yourself? You know what I mean? So they were like, they were awesome in that
right,
way.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I got encouragement from them. I confused them a lot. We got into a lot of arguments. But in the end, they were always supportive. When I wanted to play drums, they were like,
okay.
Play your drums.
Play
when
your
I wanted
drums.
To write, right. You know, they've always been pretty in my corner. So that's what I mean when I say privilege. I mean, you know, they may not have, you know, paid people off to get me jobs or something that I'm sure happens, you know, with plenty of people, but
absolutely.
They did say, you know, we're here for you and we support you. And so that, you know, that's
pretty amazing.
That was pretty ideal.
So, okay. So, you grew up in this, like you said, this suburban context that you feel like I need to break free of this.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have this chance to do so kind of as you look into colleges and as you look into where to go next.
Mm-hmm.
And you decide to stay relatively local, go mm-hmm. to Nashville, you know, the big city, the more of
the 20 minutes away.
The 20 minutes away,
hub
though,
of,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which at the time wasn't, you know, the Nashville that we're experiencing now.
Right.
So were you just like satisfied with that 20 minute, like at least I'm not at Hendersonville? Or was there ever a dream of like, I want to go to New York or I want to go to Boston or
applied, LA? I applied at Pepperdine and some other, you know,
sure.
some other schools that looked really kind of special and different to me. And I'd be lying if I said, you know, it wasn't largely because I had a big group of friends, high school friends who were going to school at MTSU for
mm-hmm.
their recording program.
Oh, yeah.
I had a girlfriend at the time who was a senior and I had just graduated. You know, I was like, you know, we'll see if I get accepted to Pepperdine. Oh, I did. Oh, but it's extremely expensive. Well,
sure.
Got into Lipscomb. I got the scholarship. So I loved where I was from. I've always kind of thought Nashville is special. And sort of has this weird, cool dichotomy of, I mean, even just Davidson County. Hendersonville is Sumner County.
Right.
But Davidson County, you can go to Bell's Bend and be, for all intents and purposes, in the country.
Yeah.
And then you can drive 15 minutes and eat at a James Beard Award-nominated restaurant that
right.
people fly in to go to.
Which
you know,
is,
now, that wasn't exactly crazy. What was going on, as you pointed out, wasn't what's happening here in 2003. But
yeah, our best was Jackson's.
Yeah, you know, R.I.P.
R.I.P.
But something that you could always get here was a dichotomy of, I was going to punk shows. I was going to the Muse, which is a R.I.P. again. That's a now closed
A
punk
Domino's.
Club. It's a Domino's, yeah, right under the, under I-24.
Which is so hilarious.
I mean, the things that happened in there, I think the health department shouldn't have even, I mean, they should have blown that building up. But like, I was going to punk shows at the Muse, Rocket Town, which was a little safer, but I was trying to see weird rock shows and punk shows and metal shows and emo shows. And Nashville offered that in addition to offering an infrastructure for making music
mm-hmm.
that sure was reliant upon country music, but was still, you know, world-class recording studios.
Yeah. What was interesting to me when I think about that era of like indie music, hardcore music at the time in Nashville, it was happening in like venues.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like today that's mostly happening in houses. And I don't see it happening. I feel like we don't have maybe there's a Muse-like place and maybe I'm just getting old and I don't know where they're at anymore.
There's a place called Dark Matter that opened on Dickerson Pike. It actually used to operate. It's bounced around a couple of times, but it's a DIY punk venue. So without going too much into like, I'm a windbag. I can go into detail on anything. But so there was a really tragic fire in Oakland, California at a place called the Ghost Ship. And I think, I don't want to get the year wrong, but I feel like it was 2016.
Sure.
It was just a few years ago. and a lot of young people died.
Right.
And DIY space, I mean, it was in the dozens of people.
I remember hearing about this.
And
yeah.
You know, fire departments across the country cracked down on these DIY spaces. There were people, you know, I didn't know my kid was going there. What's going on?
Right.
So places in town with names like the Glass Menage and, you know, oh God, I'm gonna get them all wrong. But anyway, there were like lots and lots of these little punk spots that kind of got shuttered. And, you know, I was sort of torn on it because I want, these are little kids trying to see some music. I want them to be safe,
right.
But I also want them to have those avenues where they can see the music. So there haven't been a lot of spots that have been able to spring up because young people trying to start spaces, well, you have to have a sprinkler system. You have to have two exits. It has to be ADA compliant.
Wow.
So there's not a lot of places that have popped up like that.
No.
Dark Matter is sort of the one, sort of the flower
right
that grew out of this rubble. And I think the people that are booking shows there are exactly what a scene needs. Now,
perfect.
And you know, now that I'm in my, now that I'm 30, like I'm my early 30s, my birthday is this month, and I can still say I'm in my early 30s.
Congrats.
Later this month, maybe not. But like, yeah, I'm not, my ear's not going to be the ground the same way it was when I was a 22-year-old.
Yeah.
So I'm sure I'm missing spots like that. And I'm sure they would think of me as like, oh, he's going to blow us up in the scene. We don't want him to know where our spot is. And there are still some house shows, and we'll kind of be guarded about writing about those because we don't want anybody to get shut down.
No.
But yeah, it's different than it was when I was...
early 2000s?
And I was playing
was
spaces
different.
Like that.
Yeah.
I was playing in bands that were playing in garages and lean-tos. There was a place called the Zombie Shop that we would go to shows at. I mean, there were huge shows there in a warehouse space that had a 2x4 propping up a garage door that fell and hit a guy in the head once, just like out of the blue.
My goodness.
Like, you know, and people standing on this balcony.
Yeah.
Oh, man, the guy, I know the guy who ran the place. I hope he doesn't hear this. But I mean, it was a balcony that was like, you know, particle board people standing on, you know, and there's something like exciting and cool about
exactly,
that.
Exactly, yeah.
But, you know, you can't have like 17-year-olds sneaking in there and crowding onto that and it collapse. You know,
that's true.
It's hard to find the place where both of them. That's why I think you gotta invest in like local arts communities.
Absolutely.
However you can. I mean, if you want to volunteer your time at Dark Matter, they're looking for people to do that. I mean, if you know, there's things
good.
You can do to still like reach out and be involved.
Well, and I feel like in our particular city in Nashville, we need more of that because we're slowly, it's like we're in this tug of war between, are we going to be this shiny city with all these new buildings and all this new stuff? Or are we going to keep some of this eclectic, like diversity, like uniqueness that made Nashville, Nashville? Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's this like, We have this tug of war in our city right now where it's kind of cool that all these things are happening, but then it also means like cool buildings are being torn down, restaurants and spaces that were once kind of like the go-tos. Like I will probably forever lament JJ's being gone.
Yeah.
And now low-key salty at Vanderbilt for putting a dormitory there.
Like, yeah.
That's,
I mean, you know, you hear people talk about, I've heard people, some people like to be very dramatic, say it's a battle for the soul of Nashville. I mean, look, we're like, you can look at it really big picture, which is just like the fact that, you know, people are moving into urban spaces in droves.
Right.
It's not just Nashville. I mean, we're just,
we're
packing cities out because there's more and more of us every day and, you know, and fewer and fewer jobs and, you know, in more sparse areas and that kind of thing. But as far as Nashville is concerned, we're a really interesting flashpoint, or where we were at one, or have been at one, really, where we were so excited about growth and excited to be somewhere that people were, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've heard the statistic, 100 people a day moving to Nashville, which is not exactly accurate, by the way. It never was exactly accurate, but fine, whatever. A lot of people were coming here and we were
loving it.
Yeah, but we were so eager to please people and so eager to say, oh, come here and enjoy our city. Or tourists, come here and check it out and look at, you know, the beautiful neon canyon of Lower Broad that we, you know, didn't think about the character of the city and what we were sacrificing. And a lot of things have changed, a lot of them to the detriment of our city. You kind of have to keep a healthy balance, I think, though, because, I am a Southerner. Sometimes that word coming out of my mouth, I'm like, I'm a Southerner. I am from the South, and I'm from the Nashville area.
Yeah.
And one thing that's important to us is hospitality.
Right.
And I see people with bumper stickers that say, stop moving here, we're full. And, you know, I would bet 9 times out of 10, that's on the bumper of somebody who moved here at some point.
Right.
You don't see natives, by and large, who are saying that.
No.
I mean, I am friends with a lot of natives. I'm still pretty close with a lot of my pals from high school and stuff that still live here. And we're saying, come here, just be sure that you don't trample our character and bring something to the table.
Right.
That's great. Let's talk about growth together. And it's not, go away, we're full. Because, well, guess what? They're not going to stop coming just because you said that.
Nah, that's
so let's have a conversation with our new neighbors about how do we keep these spaces special.
Well, yeah, and part of me, I do, well, and again, like we said, we, Nashville, like the people, however long you've been here, especially been here for over 10 years, we were getting so upset at always being overlooked. Like, oh, I wish the big shows would come here, or the kind of mid-sized big shows would come here. Oh, we wish we had these cool restaurants in our city, and now it's all here.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, like, we should be like, okay, here it is.
Yeah, like, yay. Oh, congratulations,
we did it. We achieved it, you know?
Yeah, and you know, there's you take the good with the bad.
Right.
I mean,
you do.
Facts of life, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and we still will get skipped over for some of the, you know, I cover a lot of film. We run a lot of film reviews in the scene. It's something that's always been really important to me.
Sure.
And, you know, we're still with film openings. Sometimes the distributor, the week of, I'll say, well, are you guys opening here? And they'll say, we don't know. I'm like, it's 4 days away. You don't know if the film is playing here or not. And they're like, well, I don't know. So we still do have struggles in certain in certain areas. But I mean,
I've noticed that. Yeah,
I think that when it comes to the conversation about what Nashville is, I think the rest of the country has gotten the memo. But we need to be careful about not sacrificing what's important to us in the city. And that means conversations about historic preservation, but it also means conversations about how we treat, you know, our immigrant communities and everything. You know, we want to be a progressive city. We want to be welcoming to those who come here.
Right.
How do we do that?
How do we do that? Man, that's good. That's good. So I want to talk a little bit about music.
Okay. Sounds good.
We kind of like touched on a little bit. So I guess to go back to your kind of like, I played in these indie rock bands. I've played at these like DIY spaces, all of that. And what I know of people who really find themselves in bands that are these local upsprings is that there is this pull to like stay in the scene, to like do the music thing, to do this scene, to do the touring, to kind of keep in that rhythm, right? Versus like settling down and like doing the like, I got a job and this is a 9 to 5 and we do this thing. And for you, like, you didn't get sucked in completely to that because you're working for the man. I guess you are the man right now.
Oh, God. I don't sign the checks.
There you go.
A man who does that.
So how did you, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's so interesting that you were able to really be deep in that scene, but not still be.
Well, I was drawn to, that's another thing. When I was, you know, earlier I was speaking about how I was sort of drawn to things like Alt Weeklies because they were professional and they had ethics and they, you know, it was real journalism, but it was also talking about the, you know, the punk shows. I mean, this is like Kurt Loder. Everybody knows Kurt Loder from MTV, right?
Absolutely.
What you might not know about him is he was covering punk's birth in the 1970s.
Yeah.
He got his like nose broken at a punk club one time when he was like 22 writing about a show. I mean, like, that's what always called to me. I thought I would get to have a foot in both worlds. And, you know, in a lot of ways I did. As I've gotten older, you know, it was just, it's pretty difficult. I know a lot of people who are kind of split their time being a touring musician and X, whatever it may be, you know, gig economy, they like managed to make it work. But I always kind of saw this as a path where I could still get to be obsessed with my kid stuff and also be, you know, professional. And the older I've gotten, the more I've written about politics and you know, activism and things that, well, I shouldn't say activism. Activism is very much a part of music in a lot of regards. Absolutely. And art.
Yeah.
But I mean, just as I've gotten older, you know, I've shifted toward more of a holistic sort of generalist journalist kind of thing. But the music thing is, what brought me in, playing right. in bands and getting to write about bands. But you want to talk about conflicts of interest, man, when you're, you know, playing in a band and you're on a bill with another band and they're like, hey, I saw that review that your paper ran of us last week and it sucked. You guys are just going to play for 10 minutes tonight instead of 20.
Wow.
Now, I mean, you know, that's just kind of a silly thing. But yeah, so I, you know, foot in both worlds was kind of the way I've lived it for, you know, a long time. And I still kind of do. I mean,
yeah.
I don't go to the amount of shows that I used to, and sure. I'm not playing in any active bands at the moment. And again, I'm not a world-class instrumentalist.
I
play four or five instruments, none of them extremely well. So it wasn't like the music scene is losing out on me or anything like that. You know, I got the opportunity to sort of make it work and thread it into what I do. And I still do a little bit. I still, you know, my social life, it's a lot of, you know, shows or DJ nights or going right. to these restaurants to check out. And it's cool that I get to write about that. And that
right.
informs what I do.
Right. So, which, I mean, yeah. You
maybe I was just too lazy to, you know, like I said, I wanted to go into law. I mean, maybe I was just too lazy to, you know, I was like, oh, if I go to law school, I won't be able to party.
Yeah, no. Well, and what we know is the law school folks, they party. I don't know how they do it.
It's a different style and degree. I find if you spread the party out and your whole life is like a low-key party, you get it out of your system and nobody gets hurt. But if you get too pent up, like law school bro style, yeah, there's no telling whether you're going to end up with your car in the river.
Yeah.
So,
car in the river, you're going to end up in front of a hearing of people. And
yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, knock on wood, I don't know that I might not end up there. But yeah, I just kind of, I think I'm lucky that I found a way to thread what I do for fun into what I do for work.
Huh. Okay. That's good. Yeah, I just think that's I just always think that it was interesting how you were so invested in that world or just involved in it and just because I see people now who are just like you almost can never imagine them not being this like person in a band, you know, like trying to make it work.
There was a time where I kind of did have to face down this decision and it was kind of made for me. I was in a band that was pretty serious and we had like to say it was pretty serious. We had put out our first LP. You know, we were playing a lot of shows. We had been together for 6 or 7 years. It was something really important to us. And we kind of got to that point, and I had been at the scene for, you know, 4 or 5 years at that point. And it was kind of like, well, you could probably be a freelance writer on the road, but you can't work a full-time gig.
No.
And, you know, a weekly newspaper, guess what they're not going to let you do? Take off 3 weeks to tour, right? Yeah. So I did kind of have to face it. And it was, but again, it was kind of made for me. That band was kind of at the point of dissolving anyway.
Okay. So, okay, let's kind of keep our, I want to go back on this journey little pathway we were on for a minute, but you go to university, study journalism, and what was your first gig at the scene? Because you've been there for
11 years this month.
11 years this month.
Well,
okay. And how did MTV come into play at that? I wanted to get to that.
I knew you were going to figure. Great. Oh man, you really just dropped that in there. Well, so I started freelancing. I'll rewind it just a little bit before the scene because that wasn't long after college. But I started freelancing pretty much immediately. I got the day job doing data entry. I was playing shows with my band at night, but I was basically finding, and this was, you know, 2007, I graduated college. So this is kind of an era where there are websites springing up all over the place. And I was just sending them clips from, you know, the Lipscomb newspaper and saying, let me write for your site. And it's the Wild West. So they're like, okay.
Yeah.
So I'm like writing for free. I'm keeping a blog. Slowly that turned into getting paid gigs and more serious gigs. And I met the music editor at the time of the Nashville scene. Her name's Tracy Moore. I met her at a party in Murfreesboro. and
as you do,
as one does, at an art show. Actually, it was an art show slash party, and just kind of told her what I'd been up to. I think we had mutual acquaintances, and she was like, "Yeah, send me a clip. If it doesn't suck, I'll put you in the scene." She's a very matter of fact person. Wow. And I sent it to her, and she's like, "Oh, it doesn't suck." So I think my first.
Do you remember the clip you sent her? Do you remember that?
I had been writing for a couple of sites. I was writing for a site called Star Pulse, and I had written something about Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings.
Nice.
I had probably written something about Dr. Dog because I think I've written about them 15 times.
Wow.
And I was running a site that I think is still active called The Deli. The Deli Nashville, which is sort of this... Try to put it nicely.
Oh, yeah,
there's a series of websites in different cities that manages, and they could be completely different now. We're talking about 12 years ago.
Sure.
I worked for them, but managed to kind of get content from hungry local writers about hungry local bands without spending very much money doing it.
So I
ran that site for a matter of months. I think I was paid one lump sum of $125.
Ooh.
So I sent Tracy, I was like, you know, I've been running this site. Here's sort of the content. And so by running that site, I've been doing editorial work more than just writing. It's like, oh, okay, you have a voice and here's what you do. And so they just put me, I think the first things I recall writing for the scene, which are so odd because I've become so close with these people and I did not know them at the time. I wrote a critic's pick on Tristan and I wrote a critic's pick on Chris Crofton. Chris Crofton is currently an advice columnist for the scene and Tristan is one of my closest friends in the world. So, like, but at the time, you know, I was just like a dude who was going out all the time. I was like, this is the funniest comedian in town and this is the best songwriter that I know.
Right.
So, those are the first two things I recall writing. And then I started to do what we call the spin, which is just live a live review column that we've had for a long time.
Yeah, that's right.
And one of the first things I remember she said, why don't you spin Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings? Because I saw that thing you wrote about them. So that was probably one of the first live reviews I did.
Yeah.
And I think I did Rodrigo and Gabriella at the Ryman was very early as well. And then just sort of slipped into the current of freelancers there. And then they had a position open about 8 months later. And I just clawed my way in and they haven't been able to get me out of the building since.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is really amazing. So now of all of these, and maybe you have one that comes to mind right away, but of all of the reviews musically, you can go film too, that you have written, are there one or two that stand out as like, man, whether or not people recognize it, but I feel like that's where I really...
I showed up
and showed out on this one.
Man, that's so
and
hard
that may
to
be
say.
Tough. That may be
that's,
tough to say. I don't know if you can pin
that's hard
that
to
down.
Say because, you know, sometimes, first of all, I mean, maybe there are people, but I think by and large, whether you're an artist or a journalist or a critic or whatever it is you do, if you create, I think that at least all of the artists and writers and journalists that I know, you're never 100% satisfied. When you're letting it go, you're just letting it go because it's the deadline is here.
Right.
I mean, it can always be better. That's what editors are for,
right?
You know.
Right.
But I mean, I can't say there's anything that has ever been perfect coming out. You know, there's a lot of things over the years. I will say this. So this isn't a review. This isn't a. It wasn't a critique. But I wrote a cover story. For the scene in 2017 about the Belcourt reopening after significant changes it underwent. And that was a significant story to me for a number of personal reasons and professional reasons. And the timing of when it came out was really important to me. And I looked back at it and I've read it since and I thought, I did this justice.
I did
what I needed to do.
I did it.
So, I mean, I don't want to sidetrack us too much, but Jim Ridley was my boss at the Nashville scene. He worked at the scene for about 25 years.
Yeah.
And he is the most brilliant editor I have ever had or will ever had. My favorite film writer of all time. Just genius. Right. Really was. He can't be overstated. He worked at the scene for a very long time, kind of shaped the voice of the scene. He was the editor in chief and I was his managing editor. I kind of rose up under him and I was his managing editor. And then one day in the office, like a lightning bolt, his heart failed and he dropped to the ground and we administered CPR and the ambulance came and took him away. And 10 days later, he was dead.
Wow.
And Jim was in the Bell Court, you know, every week of the year, multiple days a week, most times. Right. He was beloved there. He reviewed everything that came there. It was his second home. Sometimes it was more like his first home.
Wow.
I mean, he was there all the time, and they adored him. And I think that he single-handedly saved the Bell Court because it was going to close in 1999. He wrote a scene cover story that reinvigorated interest in the building. Investors came along, and next thing you know, the Bell Court was saved. So.
Wow.
His soul is in that building,
absolutely.
And that building was in him.
Right.
And he wrote a story when the Bell Court closed that, you know, they're closing, it's going to reopen, it's going to be a new era of the Bell Court. And in the interim between the time that it closed and they reopened, Jim died. So he wrote this cover story that was like, you know, here's the history of the Bell Court. It's entering a new chapter. We're all nervous. Nobody knows what it's like for the Bell Court not to be open in Nashville for 6 months. You know, that's crazy.
Right.
And then it reopened on the week of my birthday and Jim's birthday. And that's when my cover story dropped.
Wow.
So it was really sort of, you know, the most important thing I felt like I had ever written. And that's not to say that what I wrote was so great and important. It
right.
was the most
no,
important
it was,
assignment
yeah, it was
I'd ever had. I'll put
yeah.
it that way. It was the most important subject matter to me, and I still have both copies. I have Jim's cover story and mine, and they kind of are like bookends.
Yeah.
And you know, if I ever get a chance to write anything that syncs up with like what's important to me again, I feel like that's a once in a lifetime opportunity.
Yeah, honestly. It really is. Yeah. So you work under, you know, this, you know, mentor, this friend, mm-hmm. this guy that obviously, just hearing you describe that you admire and learn so much from, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I guess as you think back on the time spent, the conversations, the interactions, the back and forth, what I'm just curious, I'm always curious about what we're learning from other people. Like, mm-hmm. what were some of the wisdom, the insight, the perspectives, the way of seeing it all that you took from Jim?
The most incredible thing I learned from him, first of all, he was just like a wealth of information. He's a brilliant guy. He was like a sponge. He knew, you could ask him about any film in the history of cinema and he could give you his opinion on it, factoids on it. He was just so a wealth of information. So I learned so many things just about being a fan and being a critic and being a journalist in that way. But what I learned from him sort of philosophically, that I really make a point to try to remember in my personal life, he was never a cynic. And
wow.
man, if anybody had any right to be cynical,
right.
it was this guy who had seen his company, you know, bought and sold, seen his friends laid off. He's seen so many crappy movies. He's had so many people try to pressure him to write what they like or you know, or something positive. You know, he's encountered so many things that could have just turned you off about Nashville, about people, and he never, ever didn't give people the benefit of the doubt.
Wow.
He always had time to listen to a person. He always, you know, there's some people that, you know, they're listening and there's some people who are hearing everything that you're saying. And you never for a second felt like Jim wasn't paying attention to you. So that's just something I try to remind myself of as often as possible, is hear everybody out. Don't be cynical. Approach everything that you do from a good faith perspective. And you know, that's not to say he didn't write negative reviews. He
sure.
wrote plenty of negative reviews.
Sure.
But they were impossible to argue with. He could have an opinion of a film where you just don't disagree. And by the time you're done with that review, you're just like, he's exactly right. I still like the movie, but he is exactly right.
Wow.
You know, it was just you know.
So did you come close to understanding like why? Like, how did he, like,
he just,
how, like, what,
he had this generosity of spirit that I think
wow.
some people are
yeah.
just born with.
Yeah.
Just like a giant heart. He was so sensitive. And so, I mean, we used to joke and we still do. He would cry at the drop of a hat. It was, it was so sweet, but sometimes to the point of absurdity
right.
where, you know, he would hear that somebody we used to work with was getting married, you know, and just tears. It would just be like so sweet and so earnest. And
right.
it was always like, really? You know, oh my goodness. And he meant it. I mean, there was not a part
wow.
of him that was putting on airs. He never did. And he wanted to know about people. So, you know, I'm not born with that big of a heart. You know, I like to think I'm a good person. Right. I try to do the right thing, all that stuff. But he earnestly, deeply cared about other people. And I do care about other people. So sometimes I find myself, you know, if you're busy or short on time or you have something more important to do, it's really easy to think, I just don't have time for this. Right. But then you got to remind yourself, Jim always had time for
always
that.
Always had time.
So he was about as good as a role model as anybody could ever have. So that's just something I try to remind myself of. And
which I'm sure you didn't even anticipate happening when you started working at the scene, that you're going to come in contact with someone that's going to.
I read him. That's what's funny because I read the scene from, you know, when I was a teenager. Yeah. I knew Jim Ridley's writing. I knew he was the, you know, and I, you know, I wasn't following local politics when I was a kid or something. So I was just like flipping to the film section and being like, this guy is hilarious and weird and he likes weird stuff. This is great. So I knew Jim Ridley going in, but I didn't know who he was. He was this sort of larger than life character. And the Belcourt, as a matter of fact, named their lobby after Jim when they reopened. So it's the Jim Ridley lobby. It's there in lights next to the. And for anybody who's listening who doesn't know, I just realized I went through this long story about the Belcourt.
Right.
But the Belcourt is a very important independent film center that has been through many iterations over the past near century.
Yeah. If you live here, you should go often, become a member. If you don't live here, go visit. It's one of the places to go see films. I go all the time.
And you know, I've traveled a bit and talked to other journalists and other film fans, and it's really one of a kind. I mean, there are a lot of important film centers in a lot of cities, and, you know, each one has its own character.
Right.
The Belcourt is one of those few that has a really special character. I mean, it was home to the Grand Ole Opry for a period.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, the people in the mid-20th century, people don't realize that. It's just, talk about one of those special places that did development right. Yeah. You know, not everybody loved what the building turned into. Some people don't like it as much as others, but it is still there.
It's still there.
It is still showing independent films. It is still a nonprofit. Yeah. It is still, you know, in the spot where it's always been. There's a lot of things that they have done right.
Right. That's right. That's right. So we need to start landing the plane here, but
all right.
I want to know.
I told you, man, I'm a windbag.
No, it's great. What about, you've teetered with politics. I don't want you to have to get too and like, oh, tell us what you think, but like, give me like a general take of you've read lots of pieces. You cover politics kind of in a lot of ways. You've heard and seen a lot of it up close and personal in some ways. Mm-hmm. So if you had to say here, politics. Here's kind of a...
Oh, goodness gracious. You mean at large or do you mean in our city?
Sure. Yes.
Well, here's the thing. Okay. I think I've got a little nutshell thing. That's what we say in journalism, nutshell. I think I got a little takeaway that I could talk about. I think it's important for people to engage in local politics.
That's right.
I think that it is good and important that people are engaged in presidential election or the Democratic debates and paying attention to that. I think that's wonderful. I mean, we have some horrible things happening in this country right now.
Right.
Rights are being stripped away from transgender people. We're detaining children at the border. You know, there's a million ugly things that are happening in this country. So I'm glad that a lot of people are plugged in and trying to pay attention.
Right.
But let me tell you, local politics affect you the most directly,
right?
Every day.
Absolutely.
When I hear people complaining about new development in Nashville or property taxes or, you know, number of things, whatever it be, transit, not being able to get downtown, traffic, the roads sucking, whatever it is they're talking about, I say to them, who's your district council representative? What district do you live in? Who did you vote for at large? Do you care? I mean, there's a guy who's running solely on the ban scooters ticket for the at-large Metro Council seat. You know, if that's what you care about, by all means, it's not my guy. But like, you know, engage a little bit. And sometimes it can be frustrating. So I'll talk to my friends about local politics or that sort of thing. And they'll say, man, that really sucks. Nashville's character is going away. And I'll say, yeah. Who are you going to vote for? Who's running? You know, and that's not just trying to get them to refer them back to, hey, you know, I run a free publication and we write stories about this.
Right.
But no, just engage in some way, whether you're reading the scene or, you know, or any, you know, whether you're keeping up with media by going to the, you know, the mayoral debates or right. just engaging right. on social media or reading the Tennessean or whatever it may be, just plug in yeah. or ask somebody who knows.
Right.
If you see somebody who's, you know, seems, you know, who's informed, who's wearing a, you know, a John Ray Clemens shirt, tell me, okay, why is that guy?
Tell me why.
So yeah. he's a state legislator. He's running for, what's his deal? How's yeah. he different than Briley? Yeah. What should I not like about Briley? What should I like about Briley?
Right.
Just have these conversations and take a look at what your city's doing. And if you don't like it, you know, engage. And engage. That goes for the state level as well. It's a little, I don't want to get into state politics too much because we live in a state that does a lot of really, not great things at the legislative level.
That was very kind of you.
Well, that was diplomatic of me, but I mean, I don't want to go there, but you should just pay attention to what's happening in your community. And it starts locally.
Right.
And I think the best way to engage in anything you care about is starting locally
yeah.
from, you know, food
right.
and art and music to politics.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you really believe in something, find those people who support the same stuff and support them.
Okay. I love it.
That's my takeaway, I guess.
I love that. That was very good. That was very good. All right. So a quick rundown here. Let's a little speed round, if you will.
Oh, okay.
We'll see how
speed round.
How speedy my speed round is.
Okay. So I have to limit my answers to like, it's like don't ramble yeah, for don't, once don't in your life. Got it. Okay.
Give me, let's say, five bands that were influential in your life.
Okay.
Either in the past or now.
Five bands.
Artists, bands,
okay.
musicians.
All right.
No order. This is just, you can kind of say them okay. as they come to you.
I'll say Built to Spill. It's an indie rock band
wow.
who's playing tomorrow night at the Basement East, as
what?
A matter of fact. Sorry, I didn't mean to timestamp this. I don't know when it comes out.
Oh, so, that's fine.
They're playing July 10th at the Basement East.
Yeah.
Built to Spill. That was an indie rock band who literally the first record I bought on vinyl was a Built to Spill album. Keep It Like a Secret, which they're playing in its entirety tomorrow night, so that's a pretty big deal for me.
You may see me there.
but also, they were just kind of, I was just trying to find alt music and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever kind of different rock I could find. That's the first thing I found that was like truly poetic and influenced me and made me want to play in bands. And, you know, I got to interview the band years later and accidentally told the lead singer that I love him.
How did he, what was his reaction?
He was like, oh, cool, man.
Cool, man.
Come say hi at the show. Which I did not because I was mortified. So Built to Spill, I'll keep the other answer shorter.
Okay.
The Beatles, I know that's like the most basic,
that's
obvious
okay.
answer, but that sculpted my understanding for what pop music is
mm-hmm.
and what songwriting is. I'm going to say Radiohead
yeah.
because that was kind of what got me out of my... I liked a lot of pop punk, just sort of reductive, kind of silly music, and that was the first sort of art rock band I listened right. to that I got really into.
Right.
I'll say Ghostface Killa,
ooh.
Because he is my favorite member of the Wu-Tang Clan, and Fish Scale is just my favorite hip-hop album of all time.
Fantastic.
And that's four, right?
Four.
So
yeah,
I
more.
Need to name a fifth.
I know.
That's tough. You know what? I'm going big picture with this one. I'm going to say Dolly Parton. Because Dolly Parton, first of all, has, I need to check on this statistic, it may have changed, but at one point she had more songs, she had registered more songs than anybody else with, I think it was BMI, it could have been
wow.
ASCAP. And also just, she's like a cultural force and a brilliant person and an LGBT ally and funny and just.
Right. She's great.
Queen of the world.
She's
so
great.
Dolly, sure. Yeah.
Three books people should read.
Oh my goodness. Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dong by Grail Marcus. My gosh, if I got that title wrong, I'm going to email you later and beg you to take it out of this.
that's
but that's just a sort of a collection of...
you can name four then, if that's what it is.
I'll name a fourth
in case that's
wrong.
Yeah.
That one, I'm going to go really like broad and basic with
that's
these
fine.
Because
that's fine.
I'll just talk about what got me into writing. That's a collection of music writing that I think is really weird and far out and different and special.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Not make it. Okay.
I'm not making it easy.
I really like Steinbeck a lot. I mean, I told you I'm going to go really obvious with this.
No, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with obvious.
But there's something about Steinbeck's. I used to read Of Mice and Men every year on my birthday just because I think it's like this perfectly told story. But if I was going to recommend a Steinbeck, I'd probably say, Grapes of Wrath.
Okay.
Just because it's just this.
Yeah.
it's such a reflection of life that it's anyway, it's crazy. The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, because that kind of did, that was a novel that did something, that novel was about the sort of the meat industry and poverty and immigration in the early 20th century.
Okay.
And it kind of did something with fiction that fiction didn't really do all that often.
Uh-huh.
And, I'm going to name one more.
Okay. This is good.
Kurt Vonnegut, Bluebeard. Because that's the Kurt Vonnegut book that nobody's going to recommend to you.
That's good.
Because it's like, it's not really sci-fi, and he's like a master of sci-fi.
Sure.
He's like the most brilliant writer of all time. But Bluebeard's just this weird, far-out, fascinating book. Can I name a fifth?
Sure.
The more I think about it,
name it. One more.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'll name one more.
Name it five.
The more I think about it, the more I realize, I'm like, oh, I got a bunch of good. The Crying of Lot 49 by Thomas Pynchon. Because that, I actually have a tattoo of the symbol from that book, so I guess it's influenced me by
tattooing your body.
But that book says a lot about like alternative means of communication, which ties into sort of like alternative media. Looking outside of what you're expected to look to as an influence, sort of finding inspiration throughout your life.
That's good.
It's kind of a broad way to put it, but most of those books are quick reads.
That's
except
good.
For Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah, except for
Drop
that
Grapes
one.
Of Wrath. That's
okay. Karaoke go-to song.
Call Me Al by Paul Simon.
That's amazing.
That was easy. I've done that 100 times. I found, so I don't have a great voice. I have an okay voice. I'm a little bit pitchy. I'm a good enough critic that I know I'm not a great singer.
That's really good.
And Paul Simon, the cool thing about that is you can impress people by knowing all the lyrics without having to look at the screen.
Right.
You don't have to have a great voice.
No.
You just know every word to it. And I kind of have a whole routine that I have sorted out. So that's my go-to.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah.
And do you have a favorite Nashville local restaurant that you...
I'll name two, if that's
name
okay.
Two.
I know,
oh,
I
absolutely.
Keep cheating.
No, but that's fine.
I'm going to go with the two sides of the Nashville coin. Number one is Folk. It's a restaurant on the east side that's run by Philip Krajek, who also owns and operates Rolf and Daughters. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
They do seafood. They do salad. It's just like this beautiful fine dining location that, you know, it's not like a cheap spot, but it's not prohibitively expensive.
No.
You can go in there and get their clam pizza and a cocktail and go on a date and like wow your date and
yep, absolutely.
And walk out without having totally broken the bank.
Right.
And the other place is called Tacos y Mariscos Lindo, Mexico. It's in Madison.
Ooh, Madison, shout out.
But Madison counts.
Madison counts, it does.
Metro Davidson County. And it's a little Mexican taqueria that's just incredible. Owned by immigrants. They do a whole roast chicken for like $12. You can get this entire chicken with tortillas, rice, beans, sides. You can get it for $12. Those are like the two dates.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm like constructing the perfect first and second date, on the first date, you take them to Folk. On the second date, you take them to Lindo, is what we call it for short. And if they like Lindo, then they're marriage material.
Wow. That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
All right. How do we feel? Feel good?
I feel great. I could, you know, I've rambled enough, right?
I think we did good. All right. I'm satisfied. I think this is good. I don't think I have anything else.
Great, man. Well,
this
thank you
fantastic.
For having me.
Thanks for coming.
It was fun.
All right. We'll see you. Peace.